Now, as I said, the greatest divine dichotomy is the one we are looking at now. There's only one being, and hence only one soul. And there are many souls in the one being. Here's how the dichotomy works. You've just had it explained to you that there is no separation between souls. The soul is the energy of life that exists within and around as the aura of all physical objects. In a sense, it is that which is holding all physical objects in place. The soul of God holds in the universe. The soul of man holds in each individual human body.
So the body is not a container, a housing for the soul. The soul is a container for the body.
That's right.
Yet there are no dividing lines between souls. There's no place where one soul ends and another begins. And so it's really one soul holding all bodies.
Correct.
Yet the one soul feels like a bunch of individual souls.
Indeed it does. Indeed I do. By design.
Can you explain how it works?
Yes. While there is no actual separation between souls, it is true that the stuff of which the one soul is made manifests in physical reality at different speeds, producing different degrees of density.
Wait a minute. Different speeds? When did speed come in?
All of life is a vibration. That which you call life, you could just as easily call it God, is pure energy. That energy is vibrating constantly, always. It is moving in waves. The waves vibrate at different speeds, producing differing degrees of density or light. This in turn produces what you would call different effects in the physical world, actually different physical objects. Yet while the objects are different and discrete, the energy which produces them is exactly the same. Let me go back to the example that you used of the air between your living room and dining room. It was a good use of imagery that just popped right out of you. An inspiration.
From guess where?
Yes, I gave it to you. Now you said there was no specific place between those two physical locations where the air of the living room stopped and the air of the dining room began.
Yeah.
That is true. If there is a place where the air of the living room becomes less dense, that is, it dissipates, becomes thinner, so too the air of the dining room. The further from the dining room you go, the less you smell dinner. Now the air in the house is the same air. There is no separate air in the dining room. Yet the air in the dining room sure seems like other air. For one thing, it smells different. So because the air has taken on different characteristics, it seems as though it is different air. But it is not. It is all the same air, seeming different. In the living room, you smell the fireplace. In the dining room, you smell dinner. You might even go into one room and say, "Phew, it's stuffy. Let's get some air in here." As if there was no air at all. And yet, of course, there's plenty of air. What you are wanting to do is change its characteristics. So you bring in some air from the outside. Yet that is the same air, too. There's only one air moving in, around, and through everything.
This is cool. This is really cool. I mean, I totally get this. I love the way you explain the universe to me in ways I can totally get.
Well, thank you. I'm trying here. So let me go on.
Please, please.
Like the air in your house, the energy of life, what we'll call the soul of God, takes on different characteristics as it surrounds different physical objects. Indeed, that energy coalesces in a particular way to form those objects. As particles of energy join together to form physical matter, they become very concentrated, mashed up, pushed together. They begin to look like, even feel like, distinct units. That is, they begin to seem separate, different from all the other energy. Yet this is all the same energy behaving differently. It is this very act of behaving differently which makes it possible for that which is all to manifest as that which is many. As I explained in Book One, that which is could not experience itself as what it is until it developed this ability to differentiate. So that which is all separated into that which is this and that which is that. I'm trying to make this very simple now.
Thank you.
The clumps of energy, which coalesced into discrete units that held in physical beings, are what you have chosen to call souls. Parts of me that have become the lot of you are what we are talking about here. Thus, the divine dichotomy. There is only one of us. There are many of us.
Whoa, this is great.
You're telling me? Shall I go on?
No, no, stop here. I'm bored. Yes, go on.
Okay. Now, as energy coalesces, it becomes, as I said, very concentrated. But the further one moves from the point of this concentration, the more dissipated the energy becomes. The air becomes thinner, the aura fades. The energy never completely disappears, because it cannot. It is the stuff of which everything is made. It's all there is. Yet it can become very, very thin, very subtle, almost not there. Then, in another place, read that, another part of itself. It can again coalesce, once more clumping together to form what you call matter, and what looks like a discrete unit. Now the two units appear separate from each other, and in truth, there is no separation at all. This is, in very, very simple, elementary terms, the explanation behind the whole physical universe.
Oh, but can it be true? How do I know I haven't just made this all up?
Your scientists are already discovering that the building blocks of all of life are the same. They brought back rocks from the moon and found the same stuff they find in trees. They take apart a tree and find the same stuff they find in you. I tell you this, we are all the same stuff. We are all the same energy, coalesced, compressed in different ways to create different forms and different matter. Nothing matters in and of itself. That is, nothing can become matter all by itself. Jesus said, without the Father, I am nothing. The Father of all is pure thought. This is the energy of life. This is what you have chosen to call absolute love. This is the God and the Goddess, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. It is the all in all, the unmoved mover, the prime source. It is that which you have sought to understand from the beginning of time. The great mystery, the endless enigma, the eternal truth. There's only one of us. And so it is that which you are.
Thank you for being here with me in this way. Thank you for being here with all of us. For millions have heard the words in these dialogues, and millions more will yet do so. And we are breathlessly gifted by the coming of you to our hearts.
My dearest beings, I have always been in your hearts. I am only glad you can now actually feel me there. I have always been with you. I have never left you. I am you, and you are me. And we shall never be separated, ever, because that is not possible.
Yet, on some days, I feel so terribly alone. At some moments, I feel that I'm fighting this battle by myself.
That's because you have left me, my child. You have abandoned your awareness of me. Yet where there is awareness of me, you can never be alone.
How can I stay in my awareness?
Bring your awareness to others. Not by proselytizing, but by example. Be the source of the love which I am in the lives of all others. For that which you give to others, you give to yourself. Because there is only one of us.
Thank you. Yes, you've given me that clue before. Be the source. Whatever you want to experience in yourself, you have said, be the source of it in the lives of others.
Yes, this is the great secret. This is the sacred wisdom. Do unto others as you would have it done unto you. All of your problems, all of your conflicts, all of your difficulties in creating a life on your planet of peace and joy are based in your failure to understand this simple instruction and to follow it.
I get it. Once more, you've said it so plainly, so clearly that I get it. I'll try never to lose it again.
You cannot lose that which you give away. Always remember that.
Thank you. May I ask you a few more questions now about the soul?
I have one more general comment to make about life as you're living it.
Please.
You just said that there are times when you feel as though you're fighting this battle by yourself.
Yes.
What battle?
It was a figure of speech.
I think it was a real indicator of how you and many people really think of life. You have it in your head that it's a battle, that there is some kind of struggle going on here.
Well, it seems that way to me sometimes.
It is not that way inherently, and it doesn't have to seem that way ever.
You'll forgive me, but that's hard for me to believe.
Which is exactly why it hasn't been your reality. For you will make real what you believe is real. Yet I tell you this. Your life was never meant to be a struggle, and doesn't have to be, now or ever. I have given you the tools with which to create the grandest reality. You have simply chosen not to use them. Or to be more accurate, you have misused them. The tools I am referring to here are the three tools of creation. We have talked about them much in our ongoing dialogue. Do you know what they are?
Thought, word, and action.
Good. You've remembered.
Yeah.
I once inspired Mildred Hinckley, a spiritual teacher, to say, "You were born with the creative power of the universe at the tip of your tongue." That is a statement of astonishing implications, as is this truth from another teacher. "As thou hast believed, so be it done unto you." These two statements have to do with thought and word. Another teacher had this to say about action. "The beginning is God. The end is action. Action is God creating, or God experienced."
You said that in Book One.
Book One was brought through by you, my son, just as all great teachings have been inspired by me and brought through human forms. Those who allow such inspirations to move them and who fearlessly share them publicly are my greatest teachers.
I'm not sure I would put myself in that category.
The words you have been inspired to share have touched millions. Millions, my son. They have been translated into 24 languages. They have reached around the world. By what measure would you grant the status of great teacher?
By the measure of one's actions, not one's words.
That is a very wise answer.
And my actions in this lifetime do not speak well of me and certainly do not qualify me as a teacher.
You've just written off half the teachers who have ever lived.
What are you saying?
I'm saying what I said through Judith Shuckman in A Course in Miracles. You teach what you have to learn. Do you believe that you must be demonstrating perfection before you can teach how to reach it? And while you have made your share of what you would call mistakes...
More than my share.
You have also shown great courage in bringing this conversation with me forward.
Or great foolhardiness.
Why do you insist on putting yourself down like that? You all do it. Every one of you. You deny your own greatness as you deny the existence of me in you.
Not me. I've never denied that.
What?
Well, not recently.
I tell you before the cock crows. You will deny me three times. Every thought of yourself as smaller than you really are is a denial of me. Every word about yourself that puts you down is a denial of me. Every action flowing through yourself that plays out a role of not good enough or lack or insufficiency of any kind is a denial indeed, not just in thought, not just in word, but in deed.
I really didn't mean...
Do not allow your life to represent anything but the grandest version of the greatest vision you ever had about who you are. Now, what is the greatest vision you've ever had for yourself? Is it not that you would one day be a great teacher?
Well...
Isn't it?
Yes.
Then so be it. And so it is. Until you once again deny it.
I won't deny it again.
You won't?
No.
Prove it.
Prove it?
Prove it.
How?
Say right now, I am a great teacher. Go ahead, say it.
I am... You see, the problem is all this is going to be published. I'm aware that everything I'm writing on this legal pad is going to appear in print somewhere. People in Peoria are going to be reading this.
Peoria? Try Beijing.
Okay, China too. That's my point. People have been asking me, bugging me, about Book 3 since the month after Book 2 came out. I've tried to explain why it's taken so long. I've tried to get them to understand what it's like having this dialogue when you know the whole world is watching, waiting. It's not like it was with Book 1 and Book 2. Both of those were dialogues conducted in a void. I never even knew they would be books.
Yes, you did. In your heart of hearts, you did.
Well, maybe I hoped they'd be. But now I know, and it's different writing on this legal pad.
Because now you know everyone will be reading every word you write.
Yes, yes. And now you want me to say that I'm a great teacher, and it's difficult in front of all these people.
You want I should ask you to declare yourself in private? Is that how you think you empower yourself? I asked you to declare who you are in public precisely because you are in public here. The whole idea was to get you to say it in public. Public declaration is the highest form of visioning. Live the grandest version of the greatest vision you ever had about who you are. Begin the living of it by declaring it, publicly. The first step in making it so is saying it is so.
But what of modesty? What of decorum? Is it seemly to declare our grandest idea about ourselves to everyone we see?
Every great master has done so.
Yes, but not arrogantly.
How arrogant is, I am the life and the way? Is that arrogant enough for you? Now, you said you would never deny me again, yet you've spent the last 10 minutes trying to justify doing so.
I'm not denying you. We were talking here about my greatest vision of me.
Your greatest vision of you is me. That is who I am. When you deny the greatest part of you, you deny me. And I tell you, before the dawn tomorrow, you will do this 3 times.
Unless I don't.
Unless you don't. That is right. And only you can decide. Only you can choose. Now, do you know of any great teacher who was ever a great teacher in private? The Buddha? Jesus? Krishna, all were teachers in public, no?
Yes, but there are great teachers who are not widely known. My mother was one. You just said so earlier. It's not necessary to be widely known to be a great teacher.
Your mother was a harbinger, a messenger, a preparer of the way. She prepared you for the way by showing you the way. Yet you, too, are a teacher. And as good a teacher as you know your mother to be, she apparently did not teach you never to deny yourself. You will teach others.
Oh, I want to so badly. That is what I want to do.
Do not want to. You may not have what you want. You merely declare that you are in want of it. And that's where you will be left. And you will be left wanting.
All right. Okay. I don't want to. I choose to.
That's better. That's much better. Now, what do you choose?
I choose to teach others never to deny themselves.
Good. And what else do you choose?
I choose to teach others never to deny you, God. Because to deny you is to deny themselves, and to deny themselves is to deny you.
Good. And do you choose to teach this haphazardly, almost by chance, or do you choose to teach this grandly, as if on purpose?
I choose to teach it on purpose, grandly, as my mother did. My mother did teach me never to deny myself. She taught it to me every day. She was the greatest encourager I ever had. She taught me to have faith in myself and in you. I should be such a teacher. I choose to be such a teacher. Of all the great wisdoms my mom taught me, she made her whole life a teaching, not just her words. That's what makes a great teacher.
You are right. Your mother was a great teacher. And you were right in your larger truth. A person does not have to be widely known to be a great teacher. I was testing you. I wanted to see where you'd go with this.
Did I go where I was supposed to go?
You went where all great teachers go, to your own wisdom, to your own truth. That is the place to which you must always go, for it is the place you must turn around and come from as you teach the world.
I know. This I know.
And what is your own deepest truth about who you are?
I am a great teacher of eternal truth.
There you have it. Calmly said, softly spoken. There you have it. You know the truth of it in your heart. And you have only spoken your heart. You are not boasting, and no one will hear it as boasting. You are not bragging, and no one will hear it as bragging. You are not beating your chest, you are opening your heart. And there's a big difference. Everyone knows who they are in their heart. They are a great ballerina, or a great lawyer, or a great actor, or a great first baseman. They are a great detective, or a great salesperson, or a great parent, or a great architect, a great poet, or a great leader, a great builder, or a great healer. And they are, each and every one, a great person. Everyone knows who they are in their heart. If they open their heart, if they share with others their heart's desire, if they live their heartfelt truth, they fill their world with magnificence. You are a great teacher. And where do you suppose that gift comes from?
You.
And so when you declare yourself to be who you are merely declaring who I am. Always declare me as source, and no one will mind you declaring yourself as great.
Yet you've always urged me to declare myself as source.
You are the source of everything I am. The great teacher with whom you are most familiar in your life said, I am the life and the way. He also said, all these things come to me from the Father. Without the Father, I am nothing. And he also said, I and the Father are one. Do you understand?
There is only one of us.
Exactly.
Which brings us back to the human soul. Can I now ask some more questions about this? Okay. How many souls are there?
One.
Yes, in the largest sense, I know, but how many individuations of the one that is all are there?
Say, I like that word. I like the way you use that word. The one energy that is all energy individuates itself into many different parts. I like that.
I'm glad. So how many individuations did you create? How many souls are there?
I cannot answer that in terms you would understand.
Try me. Is it a constant number, a changing number, an infinite number? Have you created new souls since the original batch?
Yes, it is a constant number. Yes, it is a changing number. Yes, it is an infinite number. Yes, I've created new souls, and no, I have not.
Okay, I don't understand.
I know.
So help me.
Did you actually say that?
Say what?
So help me, God.
Oh, clever, clever. Okay, so I'm going to understand this. If it's the last thing I do, so help me, God.
I will. You are very determined, so I will help you. Although I warn you that it is difficult to grasp or understand the infinite from a perspective that is finite. We will nevertheless give it a whirl.
Coolness.
Yes, coolness. Well, let's begin by noticing that your questions infer that a reality exists called time. In truth, there is no such reality. There's only one moment, and that is the eternal moment of now. All things that have ever happened are happening now, and ever will happen are occurring in this moment. Nothing has happened before because there is no before. Nothing will happen after because there is no after. It is always and only right now. In the right now of things, I am constantly changing. The number of ways in which I individuate, I like your word. is therefore always different and always the same. Given that there is only now, the number of souls is always constant. But given that you like to think of now in terms of now and then, it is always changing. We touched on this earlier when we spoke of reincarnation and lower life forms and how souls come back. Since I'm always changing, the number of souls is infinite. Yet at any given point in time, it appears to be finite. And yes, there are new souls in the sense that they've allowed themselves, having reached ultimate awareness and unified with ultimate reality, to voluntarily forget everything and start over. They've decided to move to a new place on the cosmic wheel, and some have chosen to be young souls again. Yet all souls are part of the original batch. Since all are being created, were created, will be created in the only moment of now. So the number is finite and infinite, changing and unchanged, depending on how you look at it. Because of this characteristic of ultimate reality, I'm often called the unmoved mover. I am that which is always moving and has never moved, is always changing, and has never changed.
Okay, I get it. Nothing is absolute with you.
Except that everything is absolute.
Unless it's not.
Exactly. Precisely. You do get it. Bravo.
Well, the truth is, I think I've always understood this stuff.
Yes.
Except when I haven't.
That's right.
Unless it's not.
Exactly.
Who's on first?
No, what's on first? Who's on second?
Ta-da! So you're Abbott and I'm Costello, and this is all just a cosmic vaudeville show.
Except when it's not. There are moments and events you may want to take very seriously.
Unless I don't.
Unless you don't.
So, returning once again to the subject of souls.
Boy, that's a great book title there. The Subject of Souls.
Maybe we'll do that one.
Are you kidding? We already have.
Unless we haven't.
That's true.
Unless it's not.
You never know.
Except when you do.
You see, you are getting this. You're remembering now how it really is. And you're having fun with it. You're returning now to living lightly. You're lightening up. This is what is meant by enlightenment.
Cool.
Very cool. Which means you're hot.
Yep. That's what's called living within the contradiction. You've talked about it many times. All right, well, let's get back to this subject of souls. What's the difference between an old soul and a young soul?
A body of energy, that is to say, a part of me, can conceive of itself as young or old, depending on what it chooses after it reaches ultimate awareness. When they return to the cosmic wheel, some souls choose to be old souls and some choose to be young. Indeed, if the experience called young did not exist, neither could the experience called old. So some souls have volunteered to be called young, and some to be called old, so that the one soul, which is really all there is, could know itself completely. Similarly, some souls have chosen to be called good, and some bad, for exactly the same reason. And this is why no soul is ever punished. For why would the one soul want to punish a part of itself for being a portion of the whole? This is all beautifully explained in the children's storybook, The Little Soul and the Sun, which lays it out simply for a child to understand.
You know, you have a way of putting things so eloquently, of articulating terribly complex concepts so clearly that even a child can understand.
Thank you.
Also, here comes another question about souls. Are there such things as soul partners?
Yes, but not the way you think of them.
What's different?
You have romanticized soul partner to mean the other half of you. In truth, the human soul, the part of me that individuates, is much larger than you have imagined.
In other words, what I call the soul is bigger than I think.
Much bigger. It is not the air in one room. It is the air in one entire house. And that house has many rooms. The soul is not limited to one identity. It is not the air in the dining room, nor does the soul split into two individuals who are called soul partners. It is not the air in the living room-dining room combination. It is the air in the whole mansion. And in my kingdom, there are many mansions. And while it is the same air flowing around in and through every mansion, the air of the rooms in one mansion may feel closer. You might walk into those rooms and say, it feels close in there. So that you understand, then, there is only one soul. Yet what you call the individuated soul is huge, hovering over, in, and through hundreds of physical forms.
At the same time?
There is no such thing as time. I can only answer this by saying yes and no. Some of the physical forms enveloped by your soul are living now in your understanding. Others individuated in forms that are now what you would call dead. And some have enveloped forms that live in what you call the future. It's all happening right now, of course, and yet your contrivance called time serves as a tool allowing you a greater sense of the realized experience.
So these hundreds of physical bodies my soul has enveloped, now that's an interesting word that you use there, are all my soul partners?
That's closer to being accurate than the way you've been using the term, yes.
And some of my soul partners have lived before?
Yes, as you would describe it, yes.
Whoa, hold it. I think I just got something here. Are these parts of me that have lived before what I would now describe as my former lives?
Good thinking. You are getting it.
Thank you.
Yes, some of these are the other lives you've lived before, and some are not. And other parts of your soul are enveloping bodies that will be alive in what you call your future. And still others are embodied in different forms living on your planet right now. When you run into one of these, you may feel an immediate sense of affinity. Sometimes you may even say, we must have spent a past life together. And you will be right. You have spent a past life together, either as the same physical form or as two forms in the same space-time continuum.
This is fabulous. This explains everything.
Yes, it does.
Except one thing.
What's that?
How about when I just know that I've spent a past life with someone? I mean, I just know it. I can feel it in my bones. And yet when I mention this to them, they feel none of this at all. What's that about?
It's about your confusing the past with the future.
Huh?
You have spent another life with them. It's just not a past life.
It's a future life?
Precisely. It's all happening in the eternal moment of now. And you have an awareness of what, in a sense, has not yet happened.
Well, then why don't they remember the future, too?
These are very subtle vibrations. And some of you are more sensitive to them than others. Also, from person to person, it is different. You may be more sensitive to your past or future experience with one person than another. This usually means you've spent that other time as the part of your very huge soul enveloping the same body. Whereas when there's still that sensation of having met before, but just not as strong of one, it may mean that you have shared the same time together, but not the same body. Perhaps you were or will be husband and wife, brother and sister, parent and child, lover and beloved. These are strong bonds, and it is natural that you would feel them when you meet again for the first time in this life.
Well, if what you're saying is true, that would account for a phenomenon for which I have never been able to account. The phenomenon of more than one person in this lifetime claiming to have memories of being Joan of Arc or Mozart or some other famous person from the past. I've always thought this was proof for those who say that reincarnation is a false doctrine. For how could more than one person claim to have been the same person before? But now I see how this is possible. All that's happened is that several of the sentient beings, now being enveloped by one soul, are remembering, becoming members once again, with the part of their single soul which was, is now, Joan of Arc or Mozart. Good heavens, this blows the lid off all limitations. It makes all things possible. The minute I catch myself in the future saying, that's impossible, I'll know that all I'm doing is demonstrating that there's a great deal I don't know.
That is a good thing to remember. A very good thing to remember.
And if we can have more than one soul partner, that would explain how it's possible for us to experience those intense soul partner feelings with more than one person a lifetime, or even with more than one person at a time.
Indeed.
Then it is possible to love more than one person at a time.
Of course.
No. I mean with the kind of intense personal love that we usually reserve for one person, or at least one person at a time.
Why would you ever want to reserve love? Why would you want to hold it in reserve?
Well, because it's not right to love more than one person that way. It's a betrayal.
Who told you that?
Everybody. Everybody tells me that. My parents told me that. My religion told me that. My society tells me that. Everybody tells me that.
These are some of those sins of the father being passed on to the son. Your own experience teaches you one thing, that loving everyone full out is the most joyful thing you can do. Yet your parents, teachers, ministers tell you something else, that you may only love one person at a time that way. And we're not just talking about sex here. If you consider one person as special as another in any way, you are often made to feel that you have betrayed that other.
Right, exactly. That's how we've got it all set up.
Then you're not expressing true love, but some counterfeit variety.
To what extent will true love be allowed to express itself within the framework of the human experience? What limits shall we, indeed some would say, must we, place on that expression? If all social and sexual energies were to be unleashed without restriction, what would be the result? Is complete social and sexual freedom the abdication of all responsibility or the absolute height of it?
Any attempt to restrict the natural expressions of love is a denial of the experience of freedom. And thus a denial of the soul itself. For the soul is freedom personified. God is freedom by definition, for God is limitless and without restriction of any kind. The soul is God miniaturized. Therefore, the soul rebels at any imposition of limitation and dies a new death each time it accepts boundaries from without. In this sense, birth itself is a death and death a birth. For in birth, the soul finds itself constricted within the awful limitations of a body, and at death escapes those constrictions again. It does the same thing during sleep. Back to freedom, the soul flies and rejoices once again with the expression and experience of its true nature. Yet can its true nature be expressed and experienced while with the body? That is the question you ask, and it drives to the very reason and purpose of life itself. For if life with the body is nothing more than a prison or a limitation, then what good can come of it? And what can be its function, much less its justification?
Yes, I suppose that is what I'm asking. And I ask it on behalf of all beings everywhere who have felt the awful constrictions of the human experience. All my life I've been deeply frustrated by the world's inability to let me love everyone in exactly the way I've wanted to. When I was young, it was about not talking to strangers, not saying things inappropriately. I remember once walking down a street with my father. We came across a poor man begging for coins. I immediately felt sorry for this man and wanted to give him some of the pennies in my pocket. My father stopped me, brushed me past. "Trash," he said. "That's just trash." That was my father's label for all those who did not live up to his definitions of what it meant to be humans of worth. Later, I remember an experience of my older brother, who was no longer living with us, not being allowed into the house on Christmas Eve because of some argument he'd had with my father. I loved my brother and wanted him to be with us that night, but my father stopped him on the front porch and barred him from entering the home. My mother was devastated. It was her son from a previous marriage, and I was simply mystified. How could we not love or want my brother on Christmas Eve simply because of an argument? What kind of disagreement could be so bad that it would be allowed to ruin Christmas, when even wars were suspended for a 24-hour truce? This my little 7-year-old heart begged to know. As I grew older, I learned that it was not just anger that stopped the love from flowing, but also fear. That was why we often talked to strangers, but not just when we were defenseless children. Also, when we were adults, I learned that it was just not okay to openly and eagerly meet and greet strangers, and that there were certain etiquettes to be followed with people to whom you had just been introduced, none of which made sense to me. I wanted to know everything about that new person, and I wanted them to know everything about me. But no, the rules said you had to wait. And now in my adult life, when sexuality enters into it, I've learned that the rules are even more rigid and limiting, and I still don't get it. I find that I just want to love and be loved, that I just want to love everyone in whatever way feels natural to me, in whatever way feels good. Yet society has its rules and regulations about all this, and so rigid are they that even if the other person who's involved agrees to an experience, if society doesn't agree, those two lovers are called wrong and are thus doomed. Now what is that? What is that all about?
Well, you've said it yourself. Fear. It's all about fear.
Yes, but are these fears justified? Aren't these restrictions and constrictions only appropriate given the behaviors of our race? A man meets a younger woman, falls in love or in lust with her, and leaves his wife, for instance. I use only one example. So there she is, left with the kids and no employment skills at 39 or 43, or worse yet, left high and dry at 64 by a 68-year-old man who's become enamored of a woman younger than his daughter.
Is it your supposing that the man you described has ceased to love his 64-year-old wife?
Well, he sure acts like it.
No, it is not his wife he does not love and seeks to escape. It is the limitations he feels placed on him.
Oh, nonsense. It's lust, pure and simple. It's an old geezer simply trying to recapture his youth, wanting to be with a younger woman, unable to curb his childish appetites and keep his promise to the partner who has remained with him through all the tough and lean years.
Of course, you've described it perfectly. Yet nothing you have said has changed a thing that I have said. In virtually every case, this man has not stopped loving his wife. It is the limitations his wife places on him, or those placed on him by the younger woman, who will have nothing to do with him if he stays with his wife, that creates the rebellion. The point I'm trying to make is that the soul will always rebel at limitation of any kind. That is what has sparked every revolution in the history of humankind. Not just the revolution which causes a man to leave his wife, or a wife to suddenly leave her husband, which, by the way, also happens.
Surely you're not arguing for the complete abolition of behavioral limitations of any kind. That would be behavioral anarchy, social chaos. Surely you're not advocating people having affairs, or take my breath away, open marriage.
I do not advocate or fail to advocate anything. I am not for or against anything. The human race keeps trying to make me a for or against kind of God, and I am not that. I merely observe what is so. I simply watch you create your own systems of right and wrong, for and against, and I look to see whether your current ideas about that serve you, given what you say you choose and desire as a species and as individuals. Now, to the question of open marriage. I am not for or against open marriage. Whether you are or not depends upon what you decide you want in and out of your marriage. And your decision about that creates who you are with regard to the experience you call marriage. For it is, as I have told you, every act is an act of self-definition. When making any decision, it is important to make sure the right question is being answered. The question with regard to so-called open marriage, for instance, is not, shall we have an open marriage where sexual contact by both parties with persons outside the marriage is allowed? The question is, who am I and who are we with regard to the experience called marriage? The answer to that question will be found in the answer to life's largest question, who am I, period, with regard to anything, in relationship to anything, who am I and who do I choose to be? As I have said repeatedly throughout this dialogue, the answer to that question is the answer to every question.
God, that frustrates me. Because the answer to that question is so broad and so general that it answers no other question at all. According to these books, according to what you seem to be saying in this dialogue, I am love. That is who I really am.
Excellent. You have learned. That is correct. You are love. Love is all there is. So you are love. I am love. And there is nothing which is not love.
What about fear?
Fear is that which you are not. Fear is false evidence appearing real. Fear is the opposite of love, which you have created in your reality so that you may know experientially that which you are. This is what is true in the relative world of your existence. In the absence of that which you are not, that which you are is not.
Yes, yes, we've been through this a number of times now in our dialogue, but it feels as though you have evaded my complaint. I said that the answer to the question of who you are, which is love, is so broad as to render it a non-answer. It is no answer at all to almost any other question. You say it is the answer to every question, and I say it's not the answer to any, much less to one as specific as, should our marriage be an open marriage?
If that is true for you, it is because you do not know what love is.
Does anybody? The human race has been trying to figure that one out since the beginning of time.
Which does not exist.
Which does not exist. Yes, yes, I know. It's a figure of speech.
Let me see if I can find, using your figures of speech, some words and some ways to explain what love is.
Super. That'd be great.
The first word that comes to mind is unlimited. That which is love is unlimited.
Well, we're right back where we started from when we opened this subject. We're going around in circles.
Circles are good. Don't berate them. Keep circling. Keep circling around the question. Circling is okay. Repeating is okay. Revisiting, restating is okay.
I sometimes get impatient.
Sometimes. That's pretty funny.
Okay, okay. Go on with what you were saying.
Love is that which is unlimited. There is no beginning and no end to it. No before and no after. Love always was, always is, and always will be. So love is also always. It's the always reality. Now we get back to another word we used before, freedom. For if love is unlimited and always, then love is free. Love is that which is perfectly free. Now in the human reality, you will find that you always seek to love and to be loved. You will find that you will always yearn for that love to be unlimited, and you will find that you will always wish you could be free to express it. You will seek freedom, unlimitedness, and eternality in every experience of love. You may not always get it, but that is what you will seek. You will seek this because this is what love is. And at some deep place, you know that, because you are love. And through the expression of love, you are seeking to know and to experience who and what you are. You are life expressing life, love expressing love, God expressing God. All these words are therefore synonymous. Think of them as the same thing. God, life, love, unlimited, eternal, free. Anything which is not one of these things is not any of these things. You are all of those things, and you will seek to experience yourself as all of these things, sooner or later.
What does that mean, sooner or later?
It depends on when you get over your fear. As I've said, fear is false evidence appearing real. It is that which you are not. You will seek to experience that which you are when you are through experiencing that which you are not.
Who wants to experience fear?
Nobody wants to. You're taught to. A child experiences no fear. He thinks he can do anything. Nor does a child experience lack of freedom.
She thinks she can love anyone. Nor does a child experience lack of life. Children believe they will live forever, and people who act like children think nothing can hurt them. Nor does a child know any ungodly things until that child is taught ungodly things by grown-ups. And so children run around naked and hug everyone, thinking nothing of it. Adults could only do the same thing.
Well, children do so with the beauty of innocence. Adults can't get back to that innocence, because when adults get naked, there's always that sex thing.
Yes, and of course, God forbid that that sex thing be innocent and freely experienced.
Well, actually, God did forbid it. Adam and Eve were perfectly happy running around naked in the Garden of Eden until Eve ate of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and then you condemned us to our present state, for we are all guilty of that original sin.
I did no such thing.
I know. But I had to give organized religion a shot here.
Try to avoid that if you can.
Yes, I should. Organized religionists have very little sense of humor.
There you go again.
Sorry.
As I was saying, you will strive as a species to experience a love that is unlimited, eternal, and free. The institution of marriage has been your attempt at creating eternality. With it, you agreed to become partners for life, but this did little to produce a love which was unlimited and free.
Why not? If the marriage is freely chosen, isn't it an expression of freedom? And to say that you are going to demonstrate your love sexually with no one else but your spouse is not a limitation, it's a choice. And a choice is not a limitation, it's the exercise of freedom.
So long as that continues to be the choice, yes.
Well, it has to be. That was the promise.
Yes, and that's where the trouble begins.
Help me here.
Look, there may come a time when you want to experience a high degree of specialness in a relationship. Not that one person is more special to you than another, but that the way you choose to demonstrate with one person the depth of love you have for all people and for life itself is unique to that person alone. Indeed, the way you now demonstrate love to each person you do love is unique. You demonstrate your love to no two people in exactly the same way. Because you are a creature and a creator of originality. Everything you create is original. It is not possible for any thought, word, or action to be duplicative. You cannot duplicate. You can only originate. You know why no two snowflakes are alike? Because it is impossible for them to be. Creation is not duplication, and the creator can only create. That is why no two snowflakes are alike. No two people are alike. No two thoughts are alike. No two relationships are alike. And no two of anything are alike. The universe and everything in it exists in singular form, and there truly is nothing else like it.
And this is the divine dichotomy again. Everything is singular, yet everything is one.
Exactly. Each finger on your hand is different, yet it is all the same hand. The air in your house is the air that is everywhere, yet the air from room to room is not the same, but feels markedly different. It is the same with people. All people are one, yet no two people are alike. You could not, therefore, love two people in the same way, even if you tried, and you would never want to. because love is a unique response to that which is unique. So when you demonstrate your love for one person, you are doing so in a way in which you cannot do so with another. Your thoughts, words, and actions, your responses, are literally impossible to duplicate, one of a kind, just as is the person for whom you have these feelings. If the time has come when you have desired this special demonstration with one person alone, then choose it, as you say. Announce it and declare it. Yet make your declaration an announcement moment to moment of your freedom, not your ongoing obligation. For true love is always free. An obligation cannot exist in the space of love. If you see your decision to express your love in a particular way with only one particular other as a sacred promise, never to be broken, the day may come when you will experience that promise as an obligation, and you will resent it. Yet if you see this decision not as a promise, made only once, but as a free choice, made over and over, that day of resentment will never come. Remember this, there's only one sacred promise, and that is to tell and live your truth. All other promises are forfeitures of freedom, and that can never be sacred. For freedom is who you are. You forfeit freedom, you forfeit yourself. That is not a sacrament. That is a blasphemy.
So are you saying we should never make promises? That we should never promise anything to anyone?
As most of you are now living your life, there is a lie built into every promise. The lie is that you can know now how you will feel about a thing and what you will want to do about that thing on any given tomorrow. You cannot know this if you are living your life as a reactive being, which most of you are. Only if you are living life as a creative being can your promise not contain a lie. Creative beings can know how they are going to feel about a thing at any time in the future, because creative beings create their feelings rather than experiencing them. Until you can create your future, you cannot predict your future. Until you can predict your future, you cannot promise anything truthfully about it. Yet even one who both creates and predicts her future has the authority and the right to change. Change is a fundamental right of all creatures. Indeed, it is more than a right, for a right is that which is given. Change is that which is. Change is. That which is change, you are. You cannot be given this. You are this. Now, since you are change, and since change is the only thing constant about you, you cannot truthfully promise to always be the same.
Do you mean that there are no constants in the universe? Are you saying that there is nothing which remains constant in all of creativity?
The process you call life is a process of recreation. All of life is constantly recreating itself anew in each moment of now. In this process, identicality is impossible, since if a thing is identical, it has not changed at all. And while identicality is impossible, similarity is not. Similarity is the result of the process of change, producing a remarkably similar version of what went before. When creativity reaches a high level of similarity, you call that identicality. And from the gross perspective of your limited viewpoint, it is. Therefore, in human terms, there appears to be great constancy in the universe. That is, things seem to look alike and act alike and react alike. You see consistency here. This is good, for it provides a framework within which you may consider and experience your existence in the physical. Viewed from the perspective of all life, that which is physical and that which is non-physical, the appearance of constancy disappears. Things are experienced as they really are, constantly changing.
You're saying that sometimes the changes are so delicate, so subtle, that from our less discerning viewpoint they appear the same. Sometimes exactly the same, when in fact they're not.
Precisely.
There are no such things as identical twins.
Exactly. You have captured it perfectly.
And yet we can recreate ourselves anew in a form sufficiently similar to produce the effect of constancy.
Yes.
And we can do this in human relationships, in terms of who we are and how we behave.
Yes. Although most of you find this very difficult. Because true constancy, as opposed to the appearance of constancy, violates the natural law, as we have just learned. And it takes a great master to even create the appearance of identicality. A master overcomes every natural tendency, remember? The natural tendency is toward change, to show up as identicality. In truth, he cannot show up identically from moment to moment, but she can show up sufficiently similar to create the appearance of being identical.
Yet people who are not masters show up identically all the time. I know people whose behaviors and appearances are so predictable, you can stake your life on them.
Yet it takes great effort to do this intentionally. The master is one who creates a high level of similarity, what you call consistency, intentionally. A student is one who creates consistency without necessarily intending to. A person who always reacts the same way to certain circumstances, for instance, will often say, "I couldn't help it." A master would never say that. Even if a person's reaction produces an admirable behavior, something for which they receive praise, their response will often be, "Well, it was nothing. It was automatic, really. Anybody would do it." A master would never do that either. A master, therefore, is a person who, quite literally, knows what he is doing. She also knows why. People not operating at levels of mastery often know neither.
This is why it's so difficult to keep promises.
It is one reason. As I said, until you can predict your future, you cannot promise anything truthfully. A second reason people find it difficult to keep promises is that they come into conflict with authenticity.
What do you mean?
I mean that their evolving truth about a thing differs from what they said their truth would always be. And so they are deeply conflicted. What to obey, my truth or my promise?
Advice?
I've given you this advice before. Betrayal of yourself in order not to betray another is betrayal nonetheless. It is the highest betrayal.
But this would lead to promises being broken all over the place. Nobody's word on anything would matter. Nobody could be counted on for anything.
Oh, so you've been counting on others to keep their word, have you? No wonder you've been so miserable.
Who says I've been miserable?
You mean this is the way you look and act when you've been happy?
Okay, all right, so I've been miserable. Sometimes.
Oh, a great deal of the time. Even when you've had every reason to be happy, you've allowed yourself to be miserable. Worrying about whether you'll be able to hold on to your happiness. And the reason you've even had to worry about this is that holding on to your happiness has depended to a large degree on other people keeping their word.
You mean that I don't have a right to expect, or at least hope, that other people will keep their word?
Why would you want such a right? The only reason that another person would not keep their word to you would be because they didn't want to.
Or they felt they couldn't, which is the same thing. And if a person did not want to keep his word to you, or for some reason felt he just couldn't, why on earth would you want him to? Do you really want someone to keep an agreement she does not want to keep? Do you really feel people should be forced to do things they don't feel they can do? Why would you want to force anyone to do anything against his will?
Well, try this for a reason. Because to let them get away with not doing what they said they were going to do would hurt me or my family.
So in order to avoid injury, you're willing to inflict injury.
I don't see how it injures another simply to ask him to keep his word.
Yet he must see it as injurious, or he would keep it willingly.
So I should suffer the injury, or watch my family or children suffer the injury, rather than injure the one who made a promise by simply asking that it be kept?
Do you really think that if you force another to keep a promise that you will have escaped injury? More damage has been done to others by persons leading lives of quiet desperation, that is, doing what they felt they had to do, than ever was done by persons freely doing what they wanted to do. When you give a person freedom, you remove danger. You don't increase it. Yes, letting someone off the hook on a promise or commitment made to you may look like it will hurt you in the short run, but it will never damage you in the long run, because when you give the other person their freedom, you give yourself freedom as well. And so now you are free of the agonies and the sorrows, the attacks on your dignity and your self-worth that inevitably follow when you force another person to keep a promise to you that he or she does not want to keep. The longer damage will far outweigh the shorter, as nearly everyone who has tried to hold another person to their word has discovered.
Does this same idea hold true in business as well? How could the world do business that way?
Actually, it is the only sane way to do business. The problem right now in your whole society is that it is based on force, legal force, which you call the force of law, and too often physical force, which you call the world's armed forces. You have not yet learned to use the art of persuasion.
If not by legal force, the force of law through the courts, how would we persuade businesses to meet the terms of their contract or keep their agreements?
Given your current cultural ethic, there may not be another way. Yet with the change of cultural ethic, the way you are now seeking to keep businesses, and individuals for that matter, from breaking their agreements will appear very primitive.
Can you explain?
You are now using force to make sure agreements are kept. When your cultural ethic is changed to include an understanding that you are all one, you would never use force, because that would only damage yourself. You would not slap your left hand with your right.
Even if the left hand was strangling you?
That is another thing which would not happen. You would stop strangling yourself. You would stop biting your nose to spite your face. You would stop breaking your agreements. And of course, your agreements themselves would be much different. You would not agree to give something of value which you have to another only if they had something of value to give you in exchange. You would never hold back on giving or sharing something until you got what you call a just return. You would give and share automatically, and so there would be far fewer contracts to break, because a contract is about the exchange of goods and services, whereas your life would be about the giving of goods and services, regardless of what exchange may or may not take place. Yet in this kind of one-way giving would your salvation be found, for you would have discovered what God has experienced, that what you give to another, you give to yourself. What goes around comes around.
All things that proceed from you return to you.
Sevenfold. So there is no need to worry about what you are going to get back. There is only a need to worry about what you are going to give out. Life is about creating the highest quality giving, not the highest quality getting. You keep forgetting, but life is not for getting. Life is for giving. And in order to do that, you need to be forgiving to others, especially those who do not give you what you thought you were going to get. This switch will entail a complete shift of your cultural story. Today, what you call success in your culture is measured largely by how much you get, by how much honor and money and power and possessions you amass. In the new culture, success will be measured by how much you cause others to amass. The irony will be that the more you cause others to amass, the more you will amass effortlessly. With no contracts, no agreements, no bargaining or negotiating or lawsuits or courts which force you to give to each other what was promised. In the future economy, you will not do things for personal profit, but for personal growth, which will be your profit. Yet profit in material terms will come to you as you become a bigger and grander version of who you really are. In those days and times, using force to coerce someone to give you something because they said they would will seem very primitive to you. If another person does not keep an agreement, you will simply allow them to walk their path, make their choices, and create their own experience of themselves. And whatever they have not given you, you will not miss, for you will know that there is more where that came from. And they are not your source of that, but you are.
Whoa, I've got it. But it feels like we've really gotten off the mark here. This whole discussion began with my asking you about love, and if human beings would ever allow themselves to express it without limitation. And that led to a question about open marriage, and suddenly we've gotten way off the mark here.
Not really. Everything we've talked about is pertinent. And this is a perfect lead-in to your questions about so-called enlightened or more highly evolved societies. Because in highly evolved societies, there is neither marriage nor business, nor, for that matter, any of the artificial social constructions you have created to hold your society together.
Yes, well, we'll get into that soon, but right now I just want to close down this subject. You've said some intriguing things here. What all of it breaks down to is, as I get it, that most human beings can't keep promises, and so we shouldn't make them. That pretty much scuttles the institution of marriage.
I like your use of the word institution here. Most people experience that when they are in a marriage. They are in an institution.
Yes, it's either a mental institution or a penal institution, or at the very least, an institution of higher learning.
Exactly, precisely. That's how most people experience
it. Well, I was kidding along with you here, but I wouldn't say most people. There are still millions of people who love the institution of marriage and want to protect it.
I'll stand by the statement. Most people have a very difficult time with marriage and do not like what it does to them. Your worldwide divorce statistics prove this.
Are you saying that marriage should go?
I have no preference in the matter, only...
I know. Observations.
Bravo. You keep wanting to make me a god of preferences, which I am not. Thank you for trying to stop that.
Well, we've not only just scuttled marriage, we've also just scuttled religion.
It is true that religions could not exist if the whole human race understood that God doesn't have preferences, because a religion purports to be a statement of God's preferences.
And if you have no preferences, then religion must be a lie.
Well, that's a harsh word. I would call it a fiction. It's just something you made up.
Like we made up the fiction that God prefers us to be married?
Yes, I don't prefer anything of the sort. But I notice you do.
Why? Why do we prefer marriage if we know it is so difficult?
Because marriage was the only way you could figure out to bring foreverness or eternality into your experience of love. It was the only way a female could guarantee her support and survival, and the only way a male could guarantee the constant availability of sex and companionship. So a social convention was created. A bargain was struck. You give me this and I'll give you that. In this, it was very much like business. A contract was made, and since both parties needed to enforce the contract, it was said to be a sacred pact with God, who later, when that didn't work, you created man-made laws to enforce it. But even that hasn't worked. Neither the so-called laws of God nor the laws of man have been able to keep people from breaking their marriage vows.
How come?
Because those vows, as you have them normally constructed, run counter to the only law that matters.
Which is?
Natural law.
But it is the nature of things for life to express unity, oneness. Isn't that what I'm getting from all this? And marriage is our most beautiful expression of that. You know, what God has joined together, let no man put asunder, and all that.
Marriage, as most of you have practiced it, is not particularly beautiful, for it violates two of the three aspects of what is true about each human being by nature.
Will you go over it again? I think I'm just starting to pull this together.
Okay. Once more from the top. Who you are is love.
Mm-hmm.
What love is unlimited, eternal, and free.
Okay.
Therefore, that is what you are. That is the nature of who you are. You are unlimited, eternal, and free by nature. Now, any artificial social, moral, religious, philosophical, economic, or political construction which violates or subordinates your nature is an impingement upon your very self, and you will rail against it. What do you suppose gave birth to your own country? Was it not, give me liberty or give me death? Well, you've given up that liberty in your country, and you've given it up in your lives, and all for the same thing, security. You are so afraid to live, so afraid of life itself, that you've given up the very nature of your being in trade for security. The institution you call marriage is your attempt to create security, as is the institution called government. Actually, they are both forms of the same thing, artificial social constructions designed to govern each other's behavior.
Good grief. I never looked at it like that. I always thought that marriage was the ultimate announcement of love.
As you have imagined it, yes, but not as you have constructed it. As you have constructed it, it is the ultimate announcement of fear. If marriage allowed you to be unlimited, eternal, and free in your love, then it would be the ultimate announcement of love. As things are now, you become married in an effort to lower your love to the level of a promise or a guarantee. Marriage is an effort to guarantee that what is so now will always be so. If you didn't need this guarantee, you would not need marriage. And how do you use this guarantee? First, as a means of creating security, instead of creating security from that which is inside of you. And second, if that security is not forever forthcoming, as a means of punishing each other. For the marriage promise which has been broken can now form the basis of the lawsuit which has been opened. You have thus found marriage very useful, even if it is for all the wrong reasons. Marriage is also your attempt to guarantee that the feelings you have for each other, you will never have for another, or at least that you will never express them with another in the same way.
Namely, sexually.
Namely, sexually. Finally, marriage, as you have constructed it, is a way of saying, this relationship is special. I hold this relationship above all others.
What's wrong with that?
Nothing. Not a question of right or wrong. Right and wrong do not exist. It's a question of what serves you, of what recreates you in the next grandest image of who you really are. If who you really are is a being who says, this one relationship, this single one right over here, is more special than any other, then your construction of marriage allows you to do that perfectly. Yet you might find it interesting to notice that almost no one who is or has been recognized as a spiritual master is married.
Yeah, because masters are celibate. They don't have sex.
No. Because masters cannot truthfully make the statement that your present construction of marriage seeks to make, that one person is more special to them than another. This is not a statement that a master makes. And it is not a statement that God makes. The fact is that your marriage vows, as you presently construct them, have you making a very ungodly statement. It is the height of irony that you feel this is the holiest of holy promises, for it is a promise that God would never make. Yet in order to justify your human fears, you have imagined a God who acts just like you. Therefore you speak of God's promise to his chosen people, and of covenants between God and those God loves in a special way. You cannot stand the thought of a God who loves no one in a way which is more special than any other. And so you create fictions about a God who only loves certain people for certain reasons. And you call these fictions religions. I call them blasphemies. For any thought that God loves one more than another is false. And any ritual which asks you to make the same statement is not a sacrament, but a sacrilege.
Oh, my God, stop it, stop it. You're killing every good thought I ever had about marriage. This can't be God saying this. God would never say such things about religion and marriage.
Religion and marriage, the way you have constructed them, is what we are talking about here. You think that this talk is tough, I tell you this. You have bastardized the word of God in order to justify your fears and rationalize your insane treatment of each other. You will make God say whatever you need God to say in order to continue limiting each other, hurting each other, and killing each other in my name. Yea, you have invoked my name and waved my flag and carried crosses on your battlefields for centuries. All is proof that I love one people more than another, and would ask you to kill to prove it. Yet I tell you this. My love is unlimited and unconditional. That is the one thing you cannot hear, the one truth you cannot abide, the one statement you cannot accept, for its all-inclusiveness destroys not only the institution of marriage, as you have constructed it, but every one of your religions and governmental institutions as well. For you have created a culture based on exclusion, and supported it with the cultural myth of a God who excludes. Yet the culture of God is based on inclusion. In God's love, everyone is included. Into God's kingdom, everyone is invited. And this truth is what you call a blasphemy. And you must. Because if it is true, then everything you've created in your life is false. All human conventions and all human constructions are faulty to the degree that they are not unlimited. Eternal